content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the August 5th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Democrats make the case for Clinton. What happened? Hillary Clinton formally became the first female presidential nominee of a major party this week as the Democrats sought to use their convention to alter voters' negative perceptions of the former Secretary of State and Senator. The four-day event in Philadelphia got off to a rocky start as some of the frustrated delegates of Senator Bernie Sanders booed speakers, chanted, and staged demonstrations. But after Sanders gave Clinton a full-throated endorsement and called for unity, and Sanders' delegates were given the chance to cast their votes, the rebellion quieted down. "Democracy is a little messy sometimes," Sanders said. Meanwhile, a parade of high-wattage Democratic stars and celebrities sought to humanize Clinton and paint Republican nominee Donald Trump as a dangerous threat to the country. Former President Bill Clinton gave a long personal tribute to his wife, rejecting Republicans' cartoon depiction of her, highlighting her many years of advocacy for children, families, and the poor, and calling her the best darn change maker I've ever met. Michelle Obama delivered a widely praised emotional address, hailing America's racial progress and drawing sharp contrasts between Clinton and Trump. "I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves," she said. "Don't let anyone tell you this country isn't great." The First Lady said Clinton had spent her life doing the thankless, relentless work to actually make a difference in people's lives, not insulting people or tearing them down. Several other high-profile politicians praised Clinton's work in behalf of Americans, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, former President Jimmy Carter, and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Among the many non-political speakers were a 9/11 survivor whom Clinton had visited in the hospital, an illegal immigrant and her daughter, and the mothers of nine black people who died in racially charged incidents. Clinton herself, who along with President Obama was scheduled to speak after The Week went to press, appeared via video feed after her formal nomination. "We just put the biggest crack in the glass ceiling yet," she said. What the editorial said. For a while, the Democratic convention seemed doomed to collapse into hostility and chaos, said the New York Times. But the unifying speeches helped the party rise above dissension. Sanders reminded his dejected supporters that their campaign had succeeded in shifting the party platform to the left, while Michelle Obama recalled that after Clinton lost the nomination to her husband, Barack, in 2008, she didn't get angry or sulk. "Clinton certainly has her flaws, but she offers so much more than the bleak extremism and divisive rhetoric of the Trump campaign, which threatens our country's most fundamental democratic values." A long lineup of speakers told Americans that Clinton is an experienced, capable, and empathetic leader, said the Los Angeles Times. But speeches alone may not reverse voters' deep-seated distrust of her, especially after the email scandal. A recent poll found that 68% of voters do not find her honest or trustworthy, and 56% view her unfavorably. Even many Democrats are not enthused about her candidacy. Clinton and her party have their work cut out for them. What the columnist said. "Bill Clinton made a compelling case for his wife," said Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. "He humanized her with stories of her raising their daughter Chelsea, emphasized her often unglamorous work in the trenches of government, and noted that she was able to work with Republicans to compromise and get things done. Above all, he portrayed her as a committed progressive who has devoted her life to making the sorts of policy changes people on the left care about. Clinton's surrogates keep telling us we haven't yet gotten to know the real Hillary, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Sure, the public may not know all the details of her early advocacy work, but after 25 years of her in the national spotlight, Americans have an accurate enough picture. They've seen her smash-mouth partisanship, her grating insincerity, her gross money-grubbing, her serial dishonesties, and her grind-out ambition. The person who took $675,000 from Goldman Sachs to make three speeches and set up a private email server as Secretary of State to avoid public scrutiny, that was the real Hillary, too. Clinton must now walk a tightrope, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. She has sold herself as a safe pair of hands, a pragmatic incrementalist who can preserve and continue Obama's legacy. But with 70% of voters thinking the country is heading in the wrong direction, she also wants to be seen as a change maker, hence her husband's speech. Can Hillary sell herself as a steady steward and a change agent? That will take the kind of magic that even her husband didn't have. Our controversy of the week, Trump, his deep ties to Putin's regime. The fear that a U.S. presidential candidate could be a secret agent of some enemy power is an old theme in American pop culture, said Ann Applebaum in the Washington Post. But in 2016, the truth may be even stranger than fiction. Republican nominee Donald Trump has never made a secret of his creepy admiration for Russian President Vladimir Putin, whom he calls a strong leader. Putin, in turn, has used his state-controlled propaganda network, RT, to cheer on Trump's candidacy and attack Hillary Clinton as a warmonger. And then, this week, Democratic Party emails reportedly stolen by Russian hackers were released with the express purpose of dividing the Democrats and hurting Clinton's campaign. If elected, would Donald Trump be Vladimir Putin's man in the White House? Asked Paul Krugman in the New York Times. It sounds like a ridiculous question, but the ties between the two go deep. Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, previously helped Putin puppet Viktor Yanukovych become president of Ukraine. Carter Page, Trump's foreign policy advisor, has close ties to and a huge financial stake in Gazprom, the Russian energy giant. After being shut out by U.S. banks, Trump has sought financing from Russian oligarchs. His son, Donald Trump Jr., said in 2008 that Russian money makes up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. Now we know at least one reason why Trump refuses to release his tax returns. Something very strange and disturbing is going on here. Proof of that came during the Republican convention, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The Trump campaign showed little interest in the planks of the official Republican Party platform, with one exception. Trump staffers insisted that a pledge to supply Ukraine with lethal defensive weapons to fend off Putin's aggressions be watered down to a meaningless promise of appropriate assistance. Putin must be even more delighted with Trump's recent comments about NATO, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Asked if the U.S. would fulfill its NATO obligations to defend the Baltic nations of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania from a Russian invasion, Trump said he wasn't sure, and it would depend on whether they have fulfilled their obligations to us. The invitation to Putin could not have been clearer. The hysterical attempt to turn Trump into a Russian agent is pure McCarthyism, said Paul Saunders in nationalinterest.org. In his NATO comments, Trump was clearly pressuring our allies to meet their treaty requirements to spend 2% of their GDP on their own militaries. That would make Baltic nations stronger and would be worse for Russia, not better. As for the influence of Manafort and other aides, said Daniel Dresner in WashingtonPost.com, if there is anything we have learned about the Trump campaign so far, it's that non-family underlings don't matter. More investigation, though, is needed. This much is already clear, said Franklin Foer in Slate.com. If Putin could design a candidate to undermine American interests and advance his own, he'd look a lot like Donald Trump. In Trump, he has a candidate with financial ties to Russia and pro-Russian advisors. Trump is a fellow authoritarian who would divide the U.S. along racial lines, alienate our allies in Europe and the Middle East, and weaken our moral standing in the world. No doubt about it, Trump's run for the White House is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Putin, said Max Boot in LATimes.com. Trump's campaign slogan might as well be, "Make Russia Great Again." Well, it was a good week for making everything better. After police said an 86-year-old British woman fought off a would-be robber by repeatedly hitting off the offender over the head with a packet of bacon. It was a good week for bug juice after a team of scientists in India found that milk produced by the Pacific beetle cockroach for its offspring is a superfood with four times the nutritional punch of cow's milk. They recommended that this fantastic protein supplement be reproduced in the lab for humans. And it was a good week for throwing a hat in the ring after the Cat in the Hat announced his candidacy for president outside the Springfield, Massachusetts childhood home of Dr. Seuss. The cat promised to release his tax returns, work with redfish and bluefish to clean up the oceans, and to appoint Sam I Am to battle hunger. But it was a bad week for family ties after Barack Obama's half-brother said he was voting for Donald Trump. Malik Obama, who lives in Kenya but is a U.S. citizen, said he was unhappy with Hillary Clinton's record as Secretary of State and her support of gay marriage. And it was a bad week for branding. After drug dealers in Brazil were busted selling bags of cocaine labeled Rio 2016 and emblazoned with the Olympic rings. The bags also said, "Don't use near children." And it was a bad week for revisionist history. After Fox News host Bill O'Reilly responded to Michelle Obama's comment that she was proud to see her African-American daughters grow up in a house built by slaves, O'Reilly said that while that was historically accurate, the slaves were well-fed and had decent lodging. We're on the briefing page now. North Korea's nuclear threat. Kim Jong-un's hermit kingdom is amassing a nuclear arsenal that could reach South Korea, Japan, and even the U.S. How large is Kim's nuclear arsenal? His tyrannical regime now has an estimated 20 nuclear warheads and is adding a new weapon to their stockpile every 6 weeks or so, experts believe. North Korea has also been steadily upgrading its ballistic missiles. It has already successfully mounted a small nuclear warhead on a 1,500-kilometer range Rodong missile that can reach South Korea and Japan, and is on course to develop 13,000-kilometer range intercontinental ballistic missiles targeting the continental U.S. by early next decade, according to observers at Johns Hopkins University. President Obama and his predecessor, George W. Bush, allowed North Korea's nuclear escalation to take a backseat to other threats, like Iran, largely dismissing Kim's threats to burn Seoul and Manhattan down to ashes as bluffs and posturing. But the U.S. ignores North Korea's growing nuclear arsenal and the instability of its erratic leader at its peril, says Mark Fitzpatrick of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Just because Pyongyang wants us to pay attention, Fitzpatrick told The Economist, that doesn't mean we shouldn't. When did North Korea go nuclear? Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, made the nuclear program central to the dictatorial regime's identity in the early 1990s as a way of unifying the country after a devastating famine. President Bill Clinton tried to check North Korea's nuclear ambitions in 1994 with the Agreed Framework, a pact that exchanged economic aid for the freezing of the country's nuclear programs. But Pyongyang continued to provoke the West with rocket tests, and after Bush was elected in 2000, talks broke down when Pyongyang failed to provide verification of its compliance. In 2003, North Korea quit the Non-Proliferation Treaty and announced that it had nuclear weapons, carrying out its first nuclear test 3 years later. Under the leadership of 33-year-old Kim Jong-un, who came to power upon his father's death in 2011, the place of nuclear and missile tests has accelerated dramatically, culminating with a fourth nuclear test of a supposed hydrogen bomb in January. How worried should we be? It's difficult to say, given the secrecy surrounding the Hermit Kingdom. Many of its missile and nuclear tests have failed or been hyped. In January, for example, Pyongyang claimed to have detonated its first hydrogen bomb, but experts said the tremors were smaller than expected for an H-bomb. Nevertheless, the Kim regime appears to be compiling all the pieces for a deliverable atomic device. Kim recently posed with a miniaturized atomic warhead supposedly light enough to ride atop a rocket that could span the Pacific. Their systems never work first time, says aerospace engineer John Schilling, but they persevere. Would sanctions stop them? They haven't so far. The UN Security Council has just passed the toughest sanctions in two decades, however, banning the export of coal, iron, and other minerals that provide vital funds for the government's nuclear program. The success of the sanctions will depend almost entirely on China, Pyongyang's most influential ally, and the nation with which it does 90% of its trade. Beijing officially opposes Kim's bid to become a serious nuclear power and is becoming more frustrated by the belligerent ruler every day. But China's leaders will never risk punishing North Korea so severely that its regime would collapse, sparking regional chaos and sending millions of North Koreans fleeing across the border into China. What else can the U.S. do? Not a lot, except strengthen its missile defense systems at home and abroad. Last week, the Obama administration announced that it would deploy the new Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System, THAAD, T-H-A-A-D, in South Korea to reduce the chance of an attack from Kim's regime. But that doesn't mean you should just build more missile defenses and walk away, says former White House nuclear advisor Gary Samore. The THAAD system can destroy about 90% of what is fired toward South Korea. But if just one nuclear warhead slips through that net, it could kill and injure an estimated 420,000 people in Seoul. We need some kind of process to begin to freeze what the North Koreans are doing, says Samore. But nothing, including positive inducements to negotiate, has served to restrain Kim's reckless behavior. What are Kim's intentions? His primary goal is to stay in power, but otherwise he's a mystery. Kim's former classmates at his Swiss boarding school have described him as unpredictable and prone to violence. South Korea's intelligence agency recently reported that he's obsessed with the fear that he will be overthrown and that the 5-foot-9-inch dictator has swollen to 285 pounds because he copes with his anxiety by binging on food and alcohol. In his paranoia, Kim has presided over several brutal purges in his military. In 2013, he executed his uncle, Jang Song-taek, calling him a traitor and despicable human scum. International security analyst Alexandre Y. Mansourov of the Nautilus Institute warns that if the volatile tyrant believes he's about to be attacked, he could do the unthinkable. Pyongyang will likely assume the worst, Mansourov says, and rush to use the nuclear weapons out of fear of losing them to Allied preemption. Regime collapse, the aftermath. One of the biggest dilemmas China faces is trying to rein in its North Korean ally with economic sanctions, but without tipping Kim Jong-un's regime over the edge. If the regime collapses, experts agree there will be absolute chaos. There would be widespread looting by the country's starving citizens and violence in the gulags holding the country's 120,000 political prisoners. Millions of people would rush the border into China, and South Korean and U.S. troops would be forced to occupy a devastated and dysfunctional country. In his final days, Kim might choose to pass the nuclear weapons under his control to terrorists, or even launch them himself, as a final act of suicidal revenge. The regime's collapse would probably spark a brutal civil war with very high stakes, says North Korea expert Andrei Lankov, like Syria with nukes. On to the columns now. We'll take the first two come from the U.S. First, Cruz's gutsy snub. By telling Republicans to vote their consciences at the Republican National Convention, said Jonathan Tobin, Ted Cruz gave us one of the most memorable moments in modern political history. The Texas senator could have played it safe and given nominee Donald Trump a bland, perfunctory endorsement, thereby avoiding blame for hurting his chances of beating Hillary Clinton. Instead, Cruz used his nationally televised address to give his tacit blessing to true conservatives who refused to vote for a racist, protectionist, and isolationist bully. Even if his motive was calculated and at least partly political, Cruz deserves credit for his chutzpah. When other Republicans were drinking the Trump Kool-Aid, he refused to bend the knee to someone who is unworthy of the presidency. Trumpists, of course, are livid, calling Cruz a selfish, sore loser for violating a pledge by all the Republican candidates to back the eventual nominee. But Trump went far outside the boundaries of normal politics by insulting Cruz's wife as ugly and trying to link his father to the assassination of President Kennedy. In the long run, history will judge Republicans on whether they had the intestinal fortitude to stand up to Trump. Cruz will not be counted among the cowards. Longing for a golden decade. Why are so many Americans angry? Asks Robert Samuelson. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders rode a wave of populist disgust with the status quo this year, with polls showing 73% of Americans think the country is on the wrong track. But on paper, the U.S. seems to be doing quite well. The economy has largely recovered from the 2008 crash, creating 14 million new jobs. We're almost at full employment. Crime is at a historic low. Our military is no longer mired in a massive ground war. But something's missing. The sense of boundless optimism and national superiority that characterized the boom years of the late 1990s, In that decade, the internet fueled the longest economic expansion in U.S. history. The Soviet Union had collapsed, making us the world's only superpower. America was at peace, and terrorism was somebody else's problem. But in 2000, the stock market bubble burst, and 9/11 shook Americans' confidence in their safety. The Great Recession brought widespread financial insecurity, while Russia and China challenged American dominance. What angry voters want today is not change, but a repeal of all the changes of the past 16 years. That's a longing no one can fulfill. And now the last word, our in-depth article. Simone Biles' gymnastics revolution. The 19-year-old gymnast from Texas is by all accounts in a league of her own, flying higher, spinning faster, and landing cleaner than anyone before her, said journalist Dvorah Myers. In Rio, she looks unstoppable. At 9 a.m. on a Wednesday in January, Simone Biles was dancing in the middle of World Champions Center in Spring, Texas, but no music was playing. Clad in black spandex shorts and a hoodie, all Nike, her corporate sponsor, the three-time world gymnastics champion was going through the motions of her new floor routine, while Dominic Zito, the national team choreographer, stood on the sidelines watching her as she sashayed across the mat. Zito hit play on his laptop, and Brazilian music blared from the speakers. The selection was the first indication that the long-awaited Olympic year had finally arrived. Since she aged into the senior ranks in 2013, 19-year-old Biles has broken or tied every record in women's gymnastics and has been called the most talented gymnast ever. In 2015, she became the first woman to win three consecutive world all-around titles. That was also the year she broke the record for most gold medals won by a female gymnast in world championship competition. For Biles, going to the Olympics is not so much about winning as it is about not losing the gold. Biles is frequently compared to the likes of Michael Jordan or Michael Phelps, all-time greats whose legacies transcend their individual sports. This is unusual for gymnastics, which is typically treated as separate from the rest of the sporting world. As an athletic sideshow with uniquely young and small athletes, and nebulous rules and corrupt judging. But Biles' superiority is so plain to see that even the uninitiated can understand it. Today, she and her coaches are trying to crack an impossible-seeming question. How do you end the floor routine of one of the greatest athletes of all time? What pose can possibly say all of that? Most Olympic gymnast origin stories sound something like this. Little Sarah had so much energy, she was enrolled in gymnastics class. Fast forward 10 years, and she's on the Olympic team. Biles' background hews to this narrative, for the most part. As a youngster, she was extraordinarily rambunctious, climbing and jumping off everything. I remember when she was in foster care, I would go in the house to visit them. Her father, Ron Biles, told me at the family home, surrounded by their four friendly German shepherds. You had to walk up three steps into the house, and Simone would jump from the top of the steps into your arms. At that point, Ron and his wife, Nellie, weren't yet Simone's parents. They were her grandparents. Simone's biological mother, Shannon, is Ron's daughter from his first marriage. Shannon's four children had been taken from her and placed in foster care because of her substance abuse problems, something the family rarely talked about publicly until Simone's career took off. Ron first learned about the situation when a social worker reached out to him in August 1999. Simone was three and her younger sister, Adria, was just 13 months old. He told the social worker to send the kids from Columbus, Ohio, to his home in Texas. He then had to speak to Nellie about changing the composition of their family. He and Nellie had two high school age boys of their own. Ron asked her if they could bring his grandchildren into their home. "I needed to pray about it," Nellie said, but she eventually agreed. In March 2000, Ron flew up north to bring them down temporarily. It would take a few more years for their mother's parental rights to be terminated and for the four children to be permanently resettled in Texas. The older two were taken by Ron's older sister, while the younger ones went to Ron and Nellie. It wasn't until 2003 that Simone and Audrey were formally adopted. Simone, by then, was 6 years old. Since the adoption, the girls have had minimal contact with their biological mother. Simone admitted that it is strange for her to be asked about that period in her life. "It's just kind of thrown at me, and it's weird to talk about because I don't know much about it," she says. "All I know is Texas." Texas is where the life Biles remembers started. It's also where she was introduced to gymnastics by chance when she was six. She went on a daycare field trip to a gym and came home with a note for her parents that she was talented and suggested they enroll her in lessons. I have no doubt that those coaches noticed her innate gifts, fearlessness, coordination, strength, though Nellie surmised that the note was probably sent home with all of the kids who tried gymnastics that day. Biles was soon thereafter pulled into the optional training program at Bannon's Gymnastics. "We said, this kid's got talent, and we believe she's going to learn things really fast," said Amy Borman, Biles' longtime coach. But her ability to learn high-level skills quickly didn't translate immediately to strong competitive results. Biles, for all of her strengths, had some notable weaknesses. She isn't naturally flexible and couldn't find the right shapes on her leaps and jumps. She also didn't know how to control her immense power, often bounding up and back several feet after landing tumbling passes. And on bars, the most technical event in the women's repertoire, she lacked finesse. Biles' ambitions were quite modest at first. When she and her mom sat down in 2009, when she was 11 and at the top level in the Junior Olympic system, all she wanted to do was qualify for regionals. That was her big goal, Nellie recalled. Biles made it to the regional championships, where she placed 14th in the all-around. She did very poorly on bars, but won floor and placed 4th on vault. Biles' aspirations escalated incrementally. After making it to the final rung of the Junior Olympic program, she wanted to make the leap to elite, which is the level you watch at the Olympics. And once she was elite, she wanted to qualify to compete at the national championships. She was finally named to the U.S. Junior National Team when she was 15 and in the last few months of her junior eligibility. According to Biles, her career really took off in 2012 because she increased her training time. Unlike many of her peers, Biles had been enrolled in public school and only trained 5 days a week for approximately 4 hours per session. Her 20 hours per week paled in comparison with other athletes who typically squeeze in two workouts on most days for a total of 32 hours a week. But before starting high school, Biles made the call to homeschool so she could spend more time training. "My hours ramped up," she said matter-of-factly, dispelling the idea that any sort of miracle had taken place at the end of her junior career that led to her sudden rise. To Biles, it was simple math. More hours in the gym meant better outcomes in competition. Biles' first foray into international competition came in March 2013 at the American Cup in Worcester, Massachusetts. "I hadn't heard much about Biles before this, but after the vault, the first event, the focus in the arena shifted to her. She rocketed into the lead by performing the most difficult vault of the meet. Biles stayed in the lead until the balance beam, when she fell and Caitlin Ohashi edged ahead of her. After beam, Biles almost charged back into the lead, showing the powerful tumbling that would become her trademark. Ohashi, however, also hit floor and stayed in first. Biles finished in second. Biles' placement in her first senior international event, however, was not what impressed me. When she did her double-twisting, double somersault on the floor, she finished the twist and rotations so high above the mat that you started wondering if she could stash an extra twist in there. Biles made you think that the crazy skills gymnastics-happy kids dream up while playing the Olympics with dolls in their bedrooms, elements like triple-twisting, double somersaults, are actually possible. Something curious happened between 2013 and 2014. Biles went from being a contender for the title to being the inevitable winner. No other gymnast need apply for the gold. The rest of the field had all but ceded the title to her. It was at the 2014 World Championships in Nanning, China, and I watched Biles win the all-around in person. Nearly everyone I spoke to while I was there, from officials to judges to coaches, regardless of nationality, wanted to talk about the teenage Texan. They were flabbergasted by her abilities, by the seeming ease with which she performed the most difficult elements. What else can she do? Is there any way to stop her? Short answer, no. Biles can't be beaten. She often has more than a full point advantage over her nearest competitors. That's because since 2006, gymnasts receive two scores, one for how well they do their routine, a score out of 10, and another that determines how difficult the routine is by adding up the values of the skills. The two scores are then added together, so you end up with scores like 14.667 instead of 8.9 or 9.5 or 10. Biles boasts the highest start values on three of the four events. On vault, she's usually up by half a point. Same on the floor. And depending on the kind of day she has on the beam, if she moves swiftly between elements, which boosts her bonus points, she can accumulate close to another half point. But this start value advantage she has over the best gymnasts in the world doesn't fully account for the point spread in her victories. After all, at the 2014 National Championships, she fell and still won by 4 points. Ditto in 2015, where she fell again and won by almost 5 points, ahead of her close friend and national teammate Maggie Nichols, who went 8-for-8 at the competition. What makes these victory margins possible is how cleanly she executes her routines, not counting the falls, of course. When she tumbles, she rotates easily, landing with her chest up and her arms overhead. On vault, she twists cleanly. She does her full twisting double back dismount from beam with her knees together instead of pulling them apart for ease, as other former champions have, and even nails handstands on bars, her weakest apparatus. When you add her above-average difficulty to her tidy execution, you get the 2, 3, 4, even 5-point margins she's been winning by since 2014. One potential roadblock that everyone is keenly aware of is the so-called world champion jinx. There's enough anecdotal data to suggest that making the leap from world to Olympic champion is difficult. In fact, the last female gymnast to do so was Ukrainian Lilia Podkopayeva in 1996. Biles, for her part, seems less worried, at least outwardly, about the media attention and pressure. In a conference call in March, she told reporters, "I've never been to the Olympics, so I don't know what to expect. It's better for me, just like my first Worlds, my third Worlds. I knew what it was like, and so I was like, oh my goodness, but this is my first Olympics, and not knowing what to expect is good for me. It's a neat little mental trick. It seems to be working." At the Pacific Rim Gymnastics Championships, her 2016 debut, Biles was absolutely stellar. She showed an upgraded vault, which will probably assure her the vault gold in Rio. Her bar routine, once her worst event, was effortless. Her beam, sure-footed. Then there was her floor, the samba-inspired routine she first learned back in January. It had all of her trademark moments, the stratospheric tumbling, the stuck landings, the playful Marilyn Monroe-style nudity when she mimes an O with her hand over her mouth. The edges of the routine had been smoothed out. Biles hadn't quite yet reached carnival dancer levels of sultriness, but maybe you can only truly become one when you're dancing in Brazil. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in BuzzFeed. In one of the obituaries this week, the director who made feel-good comedies, Gary Marshall, 1934 to 2016. Gary Marshall was responsible for a lot of laughs. In the 1960s, he wrote scripts for TV comedies, including The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Lucy Show. He made the Broadway hit The Odd Couple into a much-loved sitcom for ABC in 1970, and 4 years later created Happy Days, a gentle parody of Middle America in the rock and roll era. After turning to movies in the 1980s, he directed box office smashes like Pretty Woman and The Princess Diaries. Critics often complained that Marshall's work was unchallenging, but he understood what his audiences wanted. Families were inviting us into their living rooms every Tuesday, he once said of Happy Days, and I felt we had an obligation to be not only entertaining, but also kind. Born in the Bronx, Marshall learned much of his humor from his mother, who doled out advice in joke form, said the Washington Post. He recalled how she once told him that the worst sin was to be boring. I said, "What is boring, Ma?" And she said, "Your father." After studying journalism at Northwestern University, he played the drums at comedy clubs, tapping out the rim shot, ba-dum-tsh, after each joke. In 1959, he made his breakthrough into TV as a writer for The Tonight Show with Jack Parr, and 2 years later moved to Los Angeles, where he worked prolifically as a screenwriter. But it was The Odd Couple, on air for 5 seasons, that launched his TV sitcom empire, said Los Angeles Times. By 1979, Marshall had 3 of the top 5 comedies on the air: Happy Days, which ran from 1974 to 84, and its spinoffs, Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy. After shifting to movies, Marshall directed a string of comedies that dealt with mismatched pairs, said the New York Times. There was Nothing in Common, a reconciliation story with Jackie Gleason and Tom Hanks as grumpy dad and resentful son. Overboard, in which Goldie Hawn's mean-spirited heiress with amnesia falls in love with Kurt Russell's widowed carpenter. And most famously, Pretty Woman, about a kind-hearted hooker, Julia Roberts, and a ruthless financier, Richard Gere. I like to do very romantic, sentimental type of work, he said as Pretty Woman was being released. It's a dirty job, but somebody has to do it. On the health and science page, to stay slim, eat more good fat. Americans have long viewed fat as a dietary enemy in the waistline wars, instead filling their shopping carts with all manner of fat-free fare. But a new study is turning conventional wisdom on its head, suggesting the key to keeping thin is eating more fat. The researchers analyzed 56 past studies investigating the link between diet and chronic diseases often tied to obesity. They found that people following a Mediterranean diet, rich in healthy unsaturated fats like olive oil, nuts, fatty fish, and avocados, along with other fruits, vegetables, legumes, and whole grains, had a 29% lower risk for heart disease and stroke. The risk for breast cancer also dropped 57%, and the chance of developing type 2 diabetes fell by 30%. The researchers argue that when it comes to obesity and related diseases, processed carbohydrates and sugar, not fat, are the real culprits. So, how much fat is good for you? It depends on the fat. If you are eating healthy fats that are monounsaturated fats like olive oil or canola oil, you don't necessarily have to limit them, study author Hannah Bloomfield of the University of Minnesota tells the Washington Post. These good fats make people feel full, she said, helping them avoid too many carbohydrates. Hottest year ever. Just halfway through 2016, sweltering June temperatures all but guaranteed that this year will surpass 2015 as the hottest ever recorded, according to NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. 2016 has really blown that out of the water, NASA's Gavin Schmidt tells Scientific American. Last month, the world was 1.62 degrees hotter than the average June in the 20th century. It was the 14th consecutive month of record heat for the planet, the longest streak of record-breaking temperatures since people began keeping records in 1881. The Earth's average global temperature for the first 6 months of 2016 was also 2.4 degrees warmer than it was in the late 19th century. A powerful El Niño was partially responsible for recent increases, but NASA says that rising concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are fueling a long-term warming trend. We are in a neighborhood beyond anything we had seen before early 2015, said NOAA's Deke Arndt. We left the 20th century far behind. This is a big deal. On the Talking Points page, Cain, Clinton's safe choice. Tim Kaine was a smart choice as Hillary Clinton's running mate, said historian Larry Sabato in the Washington Post. By selecting the Virginia senator last week, Clinton probably put his swing state firmly in the Democratic column. Kaine, a former mayor of Richmond and Virginia governor, has government experience on every level, all the while never losing an election. As vice president, he can do some heavy lifting and can also step into the presidency if needed. Passionate Bernie Sanders voters are disappointed because they had hoped Clinton would pick an outspoken liberal like Senator Elizabeth Warren. But though Kaine is no firebrand, he's a true progressive. He spent a year teaching kids at a Catholic mission in Honduras, worked as a civil rights lawyer, and compiled a strong record on LGBT issues, gun control, and climate change. Clinton has chosen a male version of herself, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. Like her, Kaine is a wonky, cautious centrist with relatively hawkish foreign policy views. He backs a no-fly zone in Syria and has criticized President Obama's cautious foreign policy credo, don't do stupid stuff, because it keeps the president from not doing stuff that's stupid not to do. Sorry, but Kaine is a horribly uninspired choice, said Melissa Wonk in the Los Angeles Times. This year, Americans aren't voting on experience or policy. They're voting on a gut feeling of, hell yes, this is my person. I lived in Virginia when he was governor, and if Kaine ever inspired a hell yes, this is my person feeling in a voter, I haven't yet met him or her. Kaine fills a different need. He was picked to shore up Clinton's trust issues, said Glenn Thrush in Politico.com. In Virginia, he earned a clean hands reputation, and you can't get a Senate colleague in either party to say a nasty thing about him. He's also a white male, a group Clinton struggles with. Yet he also can appeal to the African-American and Hispanic base. Cain speaks fluent Spanish, belongs to a primarily black Catholic church, and in the right setting shows uncommon sensitivity to the tone of conversation in minority communities. He may not be the liberal attack dog and class warrior some Democrats wanted, but Cain won't hurt Clinton and will probably help her. Ailes exit. Will Fox change? Everyone at Fox News always assumed that Roger Ailes would not leave as the network's CEO until the day he died, said Brendan James in TheGuardian.com. But last week, Ailes, 76, saw his legacy turned to ash as a growing sexual harassment scandal forced him to accept a multi-million-dollar severance package from the network. Now the question is, how will Fox survive the ousting of a man who has defined the channel and much of U.S. media for close to 20 years? Since the Clinton era, the former Republican strategist has micromanaged the network's daily narratives and crafted the broader meme of conservative dialogue, from Monica Lewinsky to the Iraq War to Benghazi. With splashy graphics and colorful game show-like sets, he hooked its older, mostly white audience on apocalyptic fear-mongering about black radicals, shrewish feminists, and villainous Muslims, building Fox into a ratings behemoth that generated more than $1 billion in profits a year. Ailes didn't just create Fox News. He is Fox News. Cable news will be a better place without Ailes, said David Zurawick in the Baltimore Sun. No man has done more to foster a rhetoric of derision and division in our nation or to create a toxic environment in which women were routinely objectified on and off screen. Ailes set the locker room tone himself, selecting the network's blonde, leggy anchors and placing them in short skirts behind translucent desks. Since former Fox anchor Gretchen Carlson filed a sexual harassment lawsuit against Ailes, at least 25 women have claimed he groped, kissed, and propositioned them behind the scenes. Whether or not that's true, said Kurt Schlichter in townhall.com, conservatives should now rally around Fox News. It's the one network that doesn't serve as a dull, goose-stepping transcriptionist for the coastal liberal elite. The left is hoping Fox collapses because it can't tolerate any dissent. Whatever happens to Fox, Ailes' demise marks the end of an age, said David Greenberg in Politico.com. The average Fox News viewer is 68. Owner Rupert Murdoch might be persuaded by his sons to broaden the network's appeal to younger viewers, who are much less socially conservative. The network's macho anti-feminist conservative populism may also have to go, along with those translucent desks. Even in the conservative kingdom Ailes built, he cannot escape the triumph of liberal ideas on gender equality. And some shorter pieces as we round out the show. First from the It Wasn't All Bad section. After 72 years of service, South Dakota's oldest nurse has finally put away her uniform. Alice Graber, 93, started nursing in World War II and found out just how many lives she's touched over the decades when she recently retired. Some 150 people, including former patients, nurses she trained, and adults she helped deliver as babies, turned up for a ceremony at the nursing home in the small town of Freeman, where she's worked for the past 20 years. I was just flabbergasted, said Graber, who plans to keep busy by volunteering at the home. Only in America. A Florida elementary school teacher who does not speak Spanish is suing the local school board after she was denied a job teaching recent immigrants in both English and Spanish. Tracy Rosner claims that she is otherwise fully qualified for the job and that not hiring her amounts to employment discrimination on the basis of race and national origin. About 32 million American TV viewers watched some or all of Donald Trump's 75-minute acceptance speech at last week's Republican National Convention. 1.9 million more than watched Mitt Romney's address 4 years ago. Overall, viewership throughout the GOP convention was about the same as in 2012. Applications to the Dallas Police Department have more than tripled since the July 7th shooting that killed five officers and injured another nine. In the aftermath of that tragedy, Police Chief David Brown challenged protesters to get off the protest line and put an application in. The department is currently receiving an average of 40 applications per day. More millennials recognize Pikachu than they do Joe Biden, according to a new survey. When shown an image, 98% of millennials polled were able to identify the yellow Pokemon character. Only 61% recognized the vice president. Out of the 17 Muslim-majority nations in the Middle East and North Africa, only Tunisia is rated as a free democracy by the organization Freedom House. That's the worst record on democracy of any region. We'll finish today with two quotes, very different quotes. The first from Alexander Solzhenitsyn: "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts." And a very different quote from Katharine Hepburn. Miss Hepburn says, "If you obey all the rules, you miss all the fun." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.